You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jake Harlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sharing the road with tractors and combines is a part of driving in most of Wisconsin, but collisions with those vehicles are more likely than we might think. We'll talk about the best ways to drive safely around farm equipment.
But first, as of mid-October, 260 residents in Milwaukee County have died of an opioid overdose this year. More than 100 of those deaths involved fentanyl, a potent synthetic opioid.
Opioid overdoses are on the rise, and our next guest wrote an article about how the drugs are affecting his community in the Milwaukee area. Edgar Mendez joins us now. He's a reporter for Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and you can see his article linked on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Edgar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We gave a few numbers there, those numbers on the rise over time, but can you paint us a picture of the story behind the numbers? What are you seeing there in Milwaukee County?
Well, overall, we've seen 309 overdose deaths, and that was through the mid-October. We're on pace, actually, to break last year's record, which was 342. And of those deaths, 84% were caused by opioids.
And what are you hearing from people in the community? You, for your piece, talk to people who had lost loved ones, sometimes multiple loved ones, to the opioid epidemic. What kind of stories did you hear?
Well, I'm hearing some stories I'm hearing over and over again are that these individuals began using prescription medications, and eventually, once their prescriptions ran out, turned to the streets to purchase opioids like Percocets and Vicodins, and eventually, when those became too expensive, turned to heroin on the streets.
And you spoke to people who'd lost loved ones who had been in and out of recovery. People looked like they were on a better path, getting out of the addiction and ultimately succumbed to it. What was it like to talk to people who had been through that?
I mean, it's tragic. And myself personally knew some of these people that were on the list that I looked at as I wrote the story. So I think that the main point was that this is touching everyone, and even though there's still some sort of a misconception that this is a suburban problem, I wanted to point out in the story that this is a very Milwaukee problem, and that, in fact, many of the victims, 70%, lived within the city, and a third were minorities.
All right, talk a little more about the demographics. Can you talk about the gender, ages, and ethnic background of people?
Well, a third of the people who died from opioid overdoses this year were women, and like I just mentioned, a third were minorities, even though the great majority are white, 68%. That's definitely probably a surprise to many people that there were so many people within our communities dying of overdoses.
We're talking to Edgar Mendez from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, looking at how the opioid epidemic is affecting Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. As he just mentioned, we've heard a lot about the suburbs and smaller towns. It's a growing problem in the Milwaukee area as well, as he's reported on. Let's talk about some of the solutions. What kind of access is there to treatment for opioids in Milwaukee County?
Well, after speaking with Rafael Mercado, he was one of the individuals who started the Facebook page Milwaukee Heroin Diaries after losing, I believe it was, four cousins to opioid overdoses within a year. What he says is that the majority of treatment available is in the suburbs, so there is treatment in Milwaukee, but I think that it's not enough to deal with the magnitude of the problem. And I think that's something that's been true for many years in terms of all the drug addiction problems there are in the city.
And you looked at a women's treatment center in particular. What did you hear from the people working there?
Right. I spoke to someone at Maida House, and what they say is that they're doing the best they can, that the majority of women they are treating are dealing with opioid addictions. But they reiterated what I just stated, is that although they can help, maybe 150, 200 women, there's just simply not enough beds, not enough treatment facilities, and even more than that, there's just not enough people coming and asking for help. There's still a stigma attached to the addiction.
in addition to the stigma that comes with addiction, a lot of times there are other problems that have gone been part of a life that led to addiction, maybe things like abuse, poverty, other problems. How does that add to the challenge?
Right. Well, they treat women, and the majority of them have dealt with trauma in the past, so I think that just adds extra layers. So on top of helping them with their drug addiction, they're helping them with things like finding housing, finding employment, helping them find childcare, things like that. So it all adds extra layers to the challenge.
And making the problem even more challenging, there's this rise of these synthetic opioids, fentanyl and others. Can you talk about how those have added to the problem?
Right. I think the rise in fentanyl is something that's going on across the nation. Well, I think that drug dealers are found a very potent cut, something they can mix into the heroin or sell it as, that increases its potency up to 50 times, and not taking any regard for human life, they're selling it to opioid addicts.
So an addict will have no idea what kind of dosage they're taking on any given day.
Many times, that's correct, yes.
Now, you also looked at what local government at the city and county levels are doing to tackle this problem. What did you find out?
Well, the county has increased funding to try to combat opioids. The county and the city created an opioid task force, but they're still in the progress of identifying best practices. So they hope to implement some programming in the future, but the reality is there's a lack of funds to support any widespread initiative that will combat problems this big.
And the opioid problem is just driving off costs automatically, right, in terms of first responders having to respond, police, ambulances, things like that. How is that affecting costs in the city and the county?
Right. Well, you're right about the first responders. We're only seeing the numbers of the people that have died, but there are so many other people that were treated and saved by first responders. So this problem is much bigger than the 260 that have died so far. So you can imagine the cost of, excuse me, not only for first responders, but also for the hospitals, child services. Everyone's getting impacted by this.
Now, President Trump recently declared opioid addiction a public health emergency. We've heard action at the state level. As you talk to people in Milwaukee City, Milwaukee County, does it seem like help is on its way from the state or federal governments?
Well, the state just received the renewal of a $7 million grant that is going to be used to combat the crisis, but there's no telling how much of that will trickle down to Milwaukee. I think the president's declaration, as Senator Tammy Baldwin said, only actually activated a little more than $50,000 in funds for treatment. So that's definitely not the solution, according to the people I talked to.
Let's talk about how this is affecting the culture in Milwaukee County. I mean, this is a big problem. It seems insurmountable, or it can look that way in some ways. Are people feeling despair or hope that this can be turned around?
I think that there's always hope. I think that there's always going to be people in the community that are working to try to solve these problems that we have. But I do know that it's affecting more and more people on a very personal level. It's hard to talk to anyone who doesn't know at least one person who's died. So it is a very tragic situation.
Yeah, Edgar, when we have call-ins related to this, it's almost exactly what you said. It's amazing how many people have had a personal impact from this, either themselves, a family member, friend, multiple friends in some cases. Are you going to be looking more into some of the stories people are telling as a follow-up to this?
Definitely looking to follow the issue and do more reporting on the impact here in Milwaukee.
Edgar, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for taking the time and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Edgar Mendez. He's a reporter for Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. We've been talking about how the opioid epidemic is affecting the Milwaukee community. It's been looked at in many ways as a suburban and rural problem. He writes that, it's happening in the big city as well. You can find his article on this topic and maybe share your own story. You can find that at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll find out how to share the road safely with tractors, combines, and other farm vehicles. Stay with us here on Central Time. An accident in the town of Lake Mills between an SUV and a farm combine left three people dead earlier this month. And this summer, in the village of Fredonia, two accidents involving tractors left some residents calling for changes to improve safety on the local highway.
Those incidents serve as a reminder that, here in Wisconsin, sharing the road with farm equipment is a fact of life, especially during harvest season. And despite slow-moving vehicle signs and flashing lights, there's still a lot for motorists to keep in mind in order to share the road safely with farmers. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer who has to go out on the road with the equipment? Have you had near misses? What do you want motorists to know about driving where you're working? And vice versa, if you drive a lot in agricultural areas, what do you try to do to stay safe? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Cheryl Skolas is with us. She is an agricultural safety and health specialist for the UW Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. And you can find her article for WisContext about avoiding collisions with farm equipment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So on one hand, given that farm equipment is large and it's slow, I think it only tops out at about 25 miles per hour, most of them, you might think that collisions would be easy to avoid. But why isn't that necessarily the case?
One of the big factors is the speed difference between that slower moving agricultural equipment and our standard motor vehicles. So if a car is moving 55 miles an hour down that highway and it comes upon that slow moving vehicle, it's a matter of seconds that to apply the brakes to stop for it. And if it's during the hours of darkness or these low gray days like we have today, you know, seeing that because of the visibility factor comes into play too.
Yeah, and on many of these roads, they're not lit or they're not lit consistently. So do we have an idea of how common accidents between farm vehicles and, you know, traditional cars and trucks are in the state?
So really, it's a very small percentage. When you look back at some of the Department of Transportation statistics, it's even hard to pull out the number of incidents because it's about less than 2% of the motor vehicle crashes involve that farm machinery and equipment. And a majority of those occur on our county or our town highways. So, you know, it's not a big percent, but when they happen, you know, it's usually a very significant crash that has resulted in some major injuries or loss of life.
And talking about those crashes, we mentioned crashes that happened both in Lake Mills and Fredonia. They happened on these county highways that we just talked about. Are there any type of road that tends to be the most high risk for these accidents?
You know, we're seeing them across all levels of roadway, probably except the interstate defense highway, because they're just not out there that often. But the state highways, especially in some of the divided highways or some of those areas like 151, where there's multiple speed ranges from 55 to 70 miles an hour, that closure time becomes an even more significant factor on those state highways. And then those rural county town roads, they fall in there to more of them, but at the same time, some different factors to the crashes.
Sure,
in that the state highways are where we're seeing some of those speed factors, the car rear-ending the equipment, they just didn't even came upon it and couldn't stop fast enough. And then on the rural roads, it's that factor of the equipment getting in position to take what we call the left-hand turn. So needing to change from their standard road position to be able to turn into a farm or a field, or even to be able to move over on the road to avoid a roadside hazard such as a mailbox, a signpost. So different factors.
Sure, and these are large pieces of equipment. They aren't as easy necessarily to maneuver as, say, a Honda Civic or something, which can dart around these things. You know, for people on the roadways, how can they maybe start thinking and incorporating what we're talking about into, I guess, more defensive driving?
So when you're going out onto those roads where you know that you're going to be, you know, going through an area where there's farmlands and fields, you know, be thinking about looking for that. If it's a typical daily route, you know, you're going to know and see the signs. It's harvest as the combines come out, as the gravity wagons start being pulled, and just, you know, taking the time to be mindful. And the one thing we want to be sure, too, is, you know, Wisconsin is a little bit different because of our dairy state. We do a lot of forage harvesting. So we get the crops planted in the spring. We still have a lot of hay that gets put up during the summertime, and then in the fall, it's bringing those grains in. So it's not like some of the states where we plant it and we harvest it. We have a long window of our cropping season and many different types and pieces of equipment. So it's not the standard 8'6", you know, semi-truck trailer out there. And you have to be, you know, looking out for those different vehicles.
We're talking to Cheryl Skolas. She is an agricultural safety and health specialist for the UW Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. She recently wrote an article about the collisions that can happen between farm equipment and traditional cars for WisConText. And we have been going through this, you know, how for those, it can be, I'm going to put it out there blankly, for people in cars, it can be a little bit annoying sometimes to be stuck behind a slow moving farm equipment. Maybe it's a tractor, maybe it's a combine. What advice do you have for people who might get, I'm going to say it nicely, irritated behind one
impatient
of these pieces of equipment?
You know, if you think about it, may be adding two stoplights worth of time to your travel. And, you know, the risk that you're putting not only that farm operator in, but yourself and whoever your occupants are in your vehicle. You know, it's hard to pass. It's even in the passing zones, it's hard to get around that equipment and be watching for it not to be, you know, coming over further because they're moving to get around something. So if you can add a few seconds, you know, to your travel time, they're not going to be going great distances. And so just, you know, find that sense of patience. Think about that great meal you've had and, you know, the food, the fiber, the fuel that it and the significance of that agriculture to the economy, and enjoy the rural area.
We're going to go to our callers right now. We have Ronald in Abrams. Hi, Ronald.
Hey. I wanted to comment. It's funny that I just got home and saw a farm tractor on the road, on the highway, pulling a load of round bales on a trailer behind them. No lights whatsoever on the tractor or the trailer or anything.
So Ronald is pointing out, and thank you for that call, Ronald, that from his perspective, he didn't see this equipment with any sort of warning at all that it was there, that it was slow moving. Is that legal?
Well, it gets into the different requirements on lighting and marking, the age of the equipment, and what would be required. If it's moving under that 25 miles an hour, there should have at least been a slow moving vehicle emblem on that rear of that trailer or somewhere on that towing vehicle to indicate it. The hours of darkness come into play, and a lot of times people don't understand what is meant by the hours of darkness or low light visibility days. So today, yeah, we would want those lights on that vehicle. But in general, if it's typically a daylight situation based on the age of equipment, they may not be needing those lights.
So throughout our conversation, a lot of the onus has been on, you know, people who are driving cars. But for people who drive a tractor on the road, you know, what kind of visibility do they have? What should they be looking out for?
So when you're operating those vehicles, there's less visibility around you. So it's really hard for a lot of, you know, from that operator's platform, depending on what, if they're towing something, to be able to see or hear that there's another vehicle in the area. So keeping your distance back so that they can have a better chance of seeing you. More equipment has extended mirrors on it these days, but it's hard to see around. Even on some of the smaller size equipment, it's hard to get that visibility behind you.
We're going to take a call now from Beth from Markazan. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
What would you like to say?
Well, I was just now behind a tractor coming down Highway 44, and, yeah, I can't see his flashing lights. I can't see because the wagon takes up all of the road behind the tractor. I obviously know there's a tractor. I encounter them all the time. My main concern is the safety of being able to, him to be able to see me and me to even be able to see his flashing lights. The other concern I have is the equipment gets very, very dirty, and those slow-moving vehicle signs that are on the back end aren't always real visible because, of course, they're dealing with a lot of grain and a lot of dirt. But I guess I'm concerned that farmers aren't being conscientious to wipe them clean so that we are able to be able to see them very well, you know.
All right, Beth, thank you so much for that call. So another concern about visibility, it feels as though the big concern across the board is tractors can't see drivers, and drivers sometimes can't see these tractors.
And, you know, to the farm community for years, we've been saying, light your equipment up like a Christmas tree when you go out there on the road. You know, add on some added retroreflective marking, add on some magnetic. You know, you want to do your best job of making that equipment visible to those other drivers so that they can see you too. Taking some time, wiping off those SMVs, wiping off your headlights, your turn signal lights, you know, throughout the harvest season, you need to be visible because you're part of sharing the road.
In the last minute that we have, has there been any reticence from maybe farmers from maybe doing that? From adding reflective things,
you know,
to their equipment?
A lot of, you know, my neighbors, I live in a farm area, and, you know, they really recognize that importance living in this Dane County urban area of having that additional lighting and marking. And so it's a cheap investment in your safety out there.
Well, we will leave it there, Cheryl. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cheryl Skolas is an agricultural safety and health specialist for the UW Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. She recently wrote an article for WisConText about how to avoid collisions with farm equipment on the roadways. You can read that on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
There's more coming up here in Central Time on the Ideas Network. Amid everything else happening in the world of politics right now, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations held an open hearing today. The topic, authority to order the use of nuclear weapons, or more bluntly, the president's unilateral authority to launch a nuclear attack. Republican Senator Bob Corker, head of that committee, has said it's time for Congress to review the realities of the president's authority to order a nuclear attack, something Congress hasn't done in about four decades.
While Corker didn't call out the current president by name, it's no secret that he's been openly and publicly feuding with the president, at one point calling the White House, quote, adult daycare. But regardless of who's in office, there are questions to be considered about who should have a say in launching a nuclear weapon and whether or not it's appropriate or safe to have that decision fall on just one person.
Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Jeremy, is it that simple? The president, whoever the president is, pretty much has unilateral authority to launch a nuclear attack if he or she sees fit?
Well, it's actually pretty complicated, Rob, because our entire nuclear structure is designed to respond to an attack upon the United States. It was not created for a first strike by the United States. So the system is set up to monitor someone attacking us and then give the president a call and ask the president if he wishes to respond. Now, the president could use a provocation such as the downing of an American aircraft or a missile fired by the North Koreans, and he called that a provocation. But then the head of strategic command, who he would contact directly or indirectly, and has to make a decision as to whether that is a legal order or not. And remember, military officers are sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States. They are not sworn loyalty to the President of the United States.
But in general, the system is designed for the president, as you say, to be able to make a quick decision in the event of a Soviet attack, is what this was designed for back in the day, basically. Is it really, is the military really going to refuse that order when it comes?
We don't know. It's never happened. I do think there would be questions raised if this seemed to come out of the blue. But I think the realistic scenario is where an American bomber is shot down near North Korea, or a North Korean missile lands in Japan or lands in Guam, and then the president uses that as a provocation to justify a nuclear strike. Then I think it's likely that the system would respond with the launch of nuclear missiles on North Korea.
We're in kind of different territory than we were during the Cold War, because all the thinking then, I think, was, well, in the event of all-out nuclear attack by one side or another, how do you make sure that we do everything we can? Now it sounds like we're talking about the use of nuclear weapons in a much more limited way in the event of, as you say, a North Korean attack of some sort.
Right. There are three things that I think have changed, Rob. One is the point you made very well, that the nature of the adversary is different and the nature of what conflict would look like. This would not be all-out full-scale thermonuclear war we're talking about. This would be a more limited set of strikes. But there are two other things that have changed. One is, of course, the nature of the president himself. Senator Porker is holding these hearings because there's concern about the stability of the President of the United States, and we have the first president ever to be callously and somewhat thoughtlessly brandishing nuclear threats, talking about bringing fire and untold destruction on other societies. That certainly has changed the calculation and concerns for people like Senator Corker. And then another thing that has changed, of course, is that we live in a world now with more nuclear powers. And this is not a bilateral crisis, U.S.-Soviet Union. This involves China, this involves Russia, this involves South Korea. So there are many, many other players involved, and our system is not designed for that either.
Talking to Jeremy Suri about the president's authority when it comes to nuclear weapons. A Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing looks at that today. And Jeremy, let's get into that now. Senator Corker, you just mentioned him, said it's time to review the realities of the president's authority. Is this a good time, regardless maybe of even who the president is now, to rethink how a nuclear launch works?
I think, Rob, this is a good time to think about authority over warfare in general. The Constitution of the United States is quite clear that any war action requires a declaration of war by Congress. But since World War II, the last time we declared war formally through Congress, Congress has ceded authority to the president because of the concerns about rapid crises that the president would have to respond to during the Cold War. We're no longer in a Cold War world, and we don't face the same kinds of immediate crises that threaten the survival of the United States. And so it seems to me it's an appropriate time, as I think Senator Corker has argued and many others have argued, for Congress to reassert its role, not simply over nuclear weapons, but over the deployment of troops, over the way we use our military force around the world. Congress has ceded too much authority. I think it's time for Congress to talk about playing its real constitutional role here.
There was this congressional authorization of the use of force. I think that the technical name was something like that back after 9/11. Presidents, multiple presidents, have got a lot of mileage out of that, using it in ways I think not initially intended. Is that one example of where Congress maybe didn't exercise enough authority?
Yes, and I think the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has made that point today, and I believe Senator Ford made that point last week, which is that we might need to rethink that resolution. It's quite similar to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that I'm sure many of your listeners remember or know about from 1964 that Lyndon Johnson used from the summer of 64 to justify the entire war in Vietnam. We have a similar situation here where a congressional resolution that was designed to respond to a particular threat at a particular moment has been stretched by Democratic and Republican presidents. And that seems to be constitutionally questionable, and I don't think it's also wise in terms of policymaking.
Looking again at the nuclear authority in particular, there's one civilian in the process, it sounds like the president, also acting as the commander-in-chief, then it goes into military hands. Is there a suggestion that more civilians, whether that's a Secretary of Defense or some sort of congressional oversight, should go into the process before the use of nuclear weapons?
I think that should be mandated in the process. Right now, the presumption is that the head of strategic command would, in all probability, especially if he's uncertain about the order, call the Secretary of Defense. Well, what makes that complicated is, of course, our Secretary of Defense now, Jim Mattis, is a military man himself. I mean, he's out of uniform, but he's not a civilian in the way in which traditional military secretaries of defense have been. So there's concern about that, and this has been a longstanding concern, Rob. In 1974, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, during Watergate, when he was concerned that Nixon was a little unsteady, requested that all military authorities come to him if there's a request from the president for the use of force. That was unconstitutional, or at least extra-constitutional, but that might be something we might want to work into the process as a required element.
As I understand it, many stages in a nuclear launch are very, very highly classified, to where people who have started the process of thinking about how we do this have been locked out of reading their own reports. Members of Congress have a very hard time accessing this kind of information. Does it make it hard for Congress to talk about something when a lot of this is opaque?
Yes, it's doubly hard because so much of it is secret, and there are some reasons why it's good that it's secret. I mean, we don't want the Russians to know where to hack into the system. So some of it, some of the problem is secrecy. And quite frankly, Rob, the biggest problem is that we've never used these procedures. So we don't actually know what would happen. What we do know is that the President of the United States would either be called because of an action overseas that seems to threaten the U.S., or he would initiate a call to the head of Strategic Command, who is a military officer. And the head of Strategic Command would then have to decide whether that is a legitimate order or not. And if he believes it is, that would trigger the beginnings of a nuclear launch. But he would have a lot of discretion as to whether to call the Secretary of Defense or not. Some have questioned whether he himself could ask to invoke the 25th Amendment. There's a lot of authority in the hands of military officers, and we don't know what they would do because we've never run this before. We've never actually been in this situation. So that's what makes this, I think, particularly scary.
We're talking about a president's power to launch nuclear strikes. It's an issue discussed this morning in front of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee, and whether or not changes might be needed. Jeremy Suri is with us, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Should the president have sole authority over firing a nuclear weapon? Does it matter who occupies the office? What alternatives could or should be considered? And what questions do you have? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation about a president's power to launch a nuclear strike. That's an issue the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee took up this morning. Our guest is Jeremy Suri. He's professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. And he's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the president have more or less unchecked powers over the nation's nuclear weapons? Is it time to review, to maybe change things? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page to your calls now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I want to say that I think that by Trump, by not saying that he wouldn't be the first to use a nuclear weapon, is actually putting us at a higher risk of there being a nuclear war by North Korea miscalculating what we're doing and thinking we're starting a nuclear war and starting a nuclear war. And the other thing I want to talk about quickly that your guest touched on is, as far as our policy in Afghanistan, Barack Obama said he was going to pull us out of Afghanistan. He never actually did. Trump said the same thing, and then he's still went with the generals and continued the war in Afghanistan. So I hope the next president actually has the courage to pull us out of there and doesn't listen to the military.
Peter, thanks for the call. So the idea of the U.S. Committing or not to not using nuclear weapons as a first strike, Jeremy.
This is a great point that Peter makes, and many scholars, myself included, have argued for the last decade that the United States should make a no-first-use pledge globally. that we would never use nuclear weapons first. There's no reason for us to use nuclear weapons first. We have such overwhelming conventional advantage. Why would we ever want to use nuclear weapons first? And by, as Peter said, by threatening or at least implying that we might use them first, that justifies other countries having nuclear weapons. It also creates the possibility where other countries might perceive, when we have a president as we do now who makes unbridled threats, they might perceive that we are about to launch our nuclear weapons and they might launch first. That's the concern here, that Kim Jong-un in North Korea might believe that we're about to start a nuclear war and that he would want to use his weapons before we launch against his. We should have a no first use pledge globally that we would never use our weapons before anyone else in a nuclear context.
Peter, thanks for that call. Go next to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, here's a scenario. How much does Putin trust Donald Trump? Donald Trump, if Donald Trump is going to send a ICBM to North Korea, but first tells Vladimir Putin, hey, this missile is headed toward North Korea, does Putin really think it's headed toward North Korea, or maybe it's really headed toward Russia?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Jeremy, confusion arising when a nuclear weapon is launched. He's giving the example of a missile in this case.
Yeah, so, I mean, the concerns about misperception are pretty serious, and there's a lot of very good work that's been done by scholars and by military officials on this. For example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States launched a test missile from California from Vandenberg Air Base, and he also had a U-2 aircraft that crossed into Soviet airspace by accident. We're lucky that those two incidents were not perceived by the Soviets as a nuclear launch by the United States. We also had a case in 1979 when Zbigniew Brzezinski, the NSC advisor, was called and told the Soviets had launched a nuclear strike. It turns out that there had been a test tape in the Strategic Air Command system, and they thought the test tape was the reality. That's why these weapons are so dangerous. The best thing we could do is be to lower the tensions around nuclear weapons and pledge not to use them first, as we just talked about, to make it less likely that there are misperceptions. The strongest argument for disarmament is the argument that the caller just made, which is the concern about these weapons being misused and misperceived in their use, creating a much larger war.
Thanks for that call. I've seen the case made, Jeremy, that of the three pieces of our nuclear puzzle, nuclear subs, bombers, and ICBM missiles, we should get rid of the missiles, because once you launch them, there's no way to take them back. You can call a bomber back, you can call a submarine back. Is that something that anybody's thinking about?
Yeah, this is an argument that's been made by many. Part of the Global Zero initiative that President Obama pushed during his first term involved just this. The problem is that many other countries, like Russia, find missiles easier to field and less expensive to manufacture than submarines. But the most secure nuclear deterrent weapons are submarines, because they're almost impossible to track. And they therefore provide you an almost guaranteed retaliatory capability. So I think fewer missiles and, quite frankly, fewer bombers would be very wise. And we've been fortunate that since the end of the Cold War, we've been able to reduce the number of missiles we deploy. In my own city of Austin, there used to be nuclear bombers and nuclear missiles. Thankfully, they're not there anymore. There were many in Wisconsin. I'm fearful we're entering back into a world where we're going to see more nuclear missiles deployed, and that's going to make us all less safe.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Jeremy, I mean, people who lived through the 60s had the fear of nuclear war, back in the 70s and 80s, too. It's been off our radar. Have we been naive all along, or is this a new scary period for us?
I think it's different from our past. We study the past because we want to study the past to understand how the present is different. And we don't really face a threat today as we did in 1983 or in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis of the United States and the Soviet Union destroying the entire planet. That's not going to happen. But we face perhaps a higher probability risk now of limited use of nuclear weapons, which would cause millions of lives to be lost. The estimates I've seen by people who have studied this closely is that even a small-scale conventional and then small-scale nuclear interchange between the United States and North Korea would result in more than a million deaths in South Korea and North Korea and the region. That's the kind of risk and danger that we face today. And that's harder to control because it involves more players. So that's all the more reason why we need to focus on these issues, not just the horrible prospect of nuclear war, but the reality of the need to control reduce these weapons, and be very careful in the kinds of threats we make. We've become a rogue nuclear state in the last year, and that's undermining our own security.
Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Suri is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. He joined us to talk about the president's unilateral power to launch a nuclear strike and why some are calling that power into question.
Interpreters are crucial to the state's court system, but finding an interpreter that speaks a rare language is a challenge. As Mary Lee Williams reports, a lack of interpreters can have serious consequences.
Could you please tell the court and the jury?
It's the last day of a two-day training for people who want to become certified court interpreters, and the classroom is full. The Hmong and Arabic speakers are practicing simultaneous interpreting, which is interpreting while being spoken to. Vab Aaron Zhang, a medical and civil interpreter, says she wants to get certified in Hmong. Her experience going through the court system as a kid influenced her decision to get certified.
Just because you can speak a language or two languages doesn't mean that you are qualified to interpret, period, let alone be a certified interpreter and know what all of the legal jargon was and all of the vocabulary and terms.
Wisconsin is in need of more certified court interpreters who speak rare languages, which is basically any language other than Spanish. Of the top five most frequently used languages last year, Hmong, Arabic, and Burmese don't have any fully certified interpreters living in the state of Wisconsin. Certified interpreters have to pass two tests, among other requirements. The oral test has a low pass rate. The state doesn't even offer a certification test for all languages, like Burmese. Carmel Kapati directs the court interpreter program in Wisconsin. She says the state needs more certified interpreters who speak rare languages. Kapati says unqualified people do come into court.
It's not just a challenge for our state, it's a challenge for all those other states that have, you know, immigrant and refugee populations of individuals who speak rare languages where they get to have their day in court too.
If one or sometimes two court interpreters can't be found in time for a trial, it can be put off, delaying justice. And if a judge notices a court interpreter isn't fulfilling their duties, they can stop everything and start over. Retired Dane County Circuit Court Judge Bill Faust worked with many interpreters during his career. He says a scheduling hearing doesn't necessarily need a certified interpreter, but contested trials are different.
You're risking having your whole court proceeding be overturned if it can later be proven that the interpreter was bad.
Enrique Soria is a certified Spanish interpreter. He says having a bad interpreter is like having a bad attorney. Soria says he once worked with somebody who misinterpreted a crucial answer to a question during a parental rights case. He says in that case, it could have changed the outcome. Interpreters work in teams during trials to make sure they catch mistakes like this, because court interpreting requires more than simply being bilingual. Still, Soria says mistakes happen.
That's why interpreters need to be trained and need to do study and need to have an extensive practice and observation so they can do this job well and do it correctly, because people's lives and careers and relationships are all at stake.
Carmel Kapati, who manages the court interpreter program, says her office is working with different departments like refugee services to try and recruit more people who speak rare languages. But it's hard when the tests are expensive, challenging, and the work is sometimes infrequent. Mary Lee Williams, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll catch up on the latest news from Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore and other big stories out of Washington.
We'll find out about efforts to preserve Wisconsin's folk culture, from traditional crafts to traditional songs.
And if you're caring for an aging relative, we've got some help for you. We'll talk to the author of the new book, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 8, from mousy cats to sheepish coyotes, a wildlife expert looks at the science of animal personalities. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony before the House Judiciary Committee today and what it means for the Russia investigation. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.